or it hadn't been raining so hard, Nina felt sure they would have taken an excursion to see the Mendenhall Glacier. But as it was, the three of them were standing at the entrance to the Glacier View nursing home instead. "Are you afraid, Mom?" Meredith asked.
"I wasn't under the impression that he'd agreed to see me," Mom said.
"Not precisely," Nina said, "but sooner or later, everyone talks to me." Mom actually smiled.
"God knows that is true."
"So are you afraid?" Nina asked.
"No.
I should have done this years ago. Perhaps if I had."
"No.
I am not afraid of telling the story to this man who is collecting such memories."
"Perhaps if you had what?" Meredith asked. Mom turned to look at them. Her face was shadowed by the black woolen hood she wore.
"I want you both to know what this trip has meant to me."
"Why do you sound like you're saying goodbye?" Nina asked.
"Today, you will hear the terrible things I did," Mom said.
"We all do terrible things, Mom," Meredith said. "You don't have to worry."
"Do we? Do we all do terrible things?" Mom made a sound of disgust. "This is the talk show babble of your generation. Here is what I want to say now, before we go in. I love both of you."
Her voice cracked, turned harsh, but her gaze softened.
"My Ninochka. My Marushka."
Before either could even respond to the sweetness of their Russian nicknames, Mom turned on her heel and walked into the nursing home. Nina rushed to keep up with her 81-year-old mother. At the desk, she smiled at the receptionist, a round-faced, black-haired woman in a beaded red sweater. "We are the Whitson family," Nina said. "I rode ahead to Dr. Adamovich and told him we'd be stopping by to see him today." The receptionist frowned, flipping through a calendar. "Oh, yes. His son Max is going to be here at noon to meet you. Would you like to have some coffee while you wait?"
"Sure," Nina said.
They followed the receptionist's directions to a waiting room filled with black and white images of Juno's colorful past. Nina took a place by the window in a surprisingly comfortable chair. Behind her, a large picture window looked out over a green forest threaded by falling rain. The minutes ticked past. People came and went, some walking, others in wheelchairs, their voices floating in and out with their presence.
"I wonder what the Velia Noche is like here," Mom said quietly, gazing out the window.
"It's better the farther north you go," Nina said, "according to my research anyway. But if you're lucky, sometimes you can see the northern lights from here."
"The northern lights," Mom said, leaning back in her orange chair.
"My papa used to take me outside in the middle of the night sometimes, when everyone else was asleep. He'd whisper, 'Varushka, my little writer,' and take my hand and wrap me in a blanket, and out we would go into the streets of Leningrad to stand and stare up at the sky. It was so beautiful. God's light show, my papa said, although he said it softly. Everything he said was dangerous then. We just didn't know it." She sighed.
"I think this is the first time I've ever just talked about him. Just remembered something ordinary."
"Does it hurt?" Meredith asked. Mom thought about that for a moment, and then said,
"In a good way. We were always so scared to mention him. This is what Stalin did to us. When I first came to the United States, I could not believe how free everyone was, how quick to say what was on their minds. And in the 60s and 70s, she shook her head, smiling, my father would have loved to see a sit-in or the college kids demonstrating. He was like them. Like Sasha and your father. Dreamers.
Vera was a dreamer, Nina said gently. Mom nodded.
For a time.
A man dressed in a flannel shirt and faded jeans walked into the room. With a thick black beard that covered half of his angular face, it was hard to make out his age.
Mrs. Whitson, he said.
Mom slowly stood. The man moved forward, his hand outstretched.
I am Maxim. My father, Vasily Adamovich, is the man you have come so far to see.
Nina and Meredith rose as one.
It is many years since your father wrote to me, Mom said.
Maxim nodded.
And I am sorry to say that he has suffered a stroke in the years between. He can barely speak and can't move his left side at all.
So we are wasting your time, Mom said.
No, not at all. I have taken up a few of my father's projects, and the siege of Leningrad is one of them. It's such important work, gathering these survivor stories. It's only in the last 20 years or so that the truth is coming to light. The Soviets were good at keeping secrets.
Indeed, Mom said.
So if you'd like to come into my father's room, I'll record your account for his study. He may not appear to react, but I can assure you that he is happy to finally include your story. It will be the 53rd first-person account he has collected. Later this year, I'm going to St. Petersburg to petition for more records. Your story will make a difference, Mrs. Whitson, I assure you.
Mom simply nodded, and Nina couldn't help wondering what she was thinking, now that they were coming to the time when the story would end.
Follow me, please, Maxim said.
Turning, he led them down the brightly lit corridor, past hunched old women with walkers and tiny old men in wheelchairs, to a room at the very end of the hall. There was a narrow, hospital-style bed in the center of the room, and a couple of chairs that had obviously been brought in for this meeting. In the bed lay a shrunken man with a bony face and toothpick arms. Tufts of white hair sprang from his bald, spotted head and his wrinkled pink ears. His nose was like a raptor's beak, and his lips all but invisible. At their entrance, his right hand began to tremble, and the right side of his mouth tried to smile.
Maxim leaned down close to his father, whispered something into his ear.
The man in the bed said something, but Nina couldn't understand a word.
He says he is so glad to see you, Anya Whitson. He has waited a long time.
My father is Vasily Adamovich, and he welcomes you all.
Mom nodded.
Please sit down, Maxim said, indicating the chairs. On a table by the window were a copper samovar and several plates of pierogies and strudel and sliced cheese with crackers. Vasily said something. His voice crackled like a dried leaf.
Maxim listened, then shook his head.
I'm sorry, Papa. I cannot understand.
He is saying something about the rain, I think. I'm not sure.
I'm going to record your story, Mrs. Whitson. Anya, may I call you Anya? Is the recording okay?
Mom was staring at the gleaming copper samovar and the row of silver-wrapped glass teacups.
"Da," she said softly, flicking a hand in dismissal.
Nina hadn't realized that she was the only one still standing. She went to the chair next to Meredith's and sat down. For a moment, the room was utterly still. The only noise in it was the tapping of the rain on the roof. Then Mom drew a long, slow breath and released it.
I have told this story in a single way for so long, I hardly know how to start now.
I hardly know how to start.
Maxim hit the record button. It made a loud clicking sound, and the tape started to roll.
I am not Anya Petrovna Whitson. This is the name I took, the woman I became. She took another deep breath. I am Veronika Petrovna Marchenko Whitson, and Leningrad is my city. It is a part of me. Long ago I knew those streets like I know the soles of my feet or the palms of my hands. But it is not my youth you are interested in. Not that I had much of one when I look back on it. I started to grow up at 15 when they took my father away, and by the end of the war, I was old. That is the middle, though. The beginning, really, is June of 1941. I am coming home from the country, where I'd been gathering vegetables to can for the coming winter. Nina closed her eyes and sat back, letting the words form pictures in her imagination. She heard things she'd heard before as a fairy tale, only this time they were real. There were no black knights or princes or goblins. There was only Vera, first as a young woman falling in love and having her babies, and then as a woman afraid, digging on the Luga line and walking through bombed-out landscapes. Nina had to wipe her tears away when Olga died, and again when Vera's mother died. She is gone, Mom says with a terrible simplicity. I hear my son say, "What's wrong with Baba?" And it takes all my strength not to cry. I pull the blanket up to Mama's chest, trying not to notice how bony her face has become in the last month. Should I have forced her to eat? This is a question that will haunt me for the rest of my life. If I had, I would have been pulling the blanket up on one of my children, and how could I have done that?
Mama, Leo says again.
Baba has gone to be with Olga, I say. And as hard as I try to be strong, my voice cracks, and then my children are crying. It is Sasha who comforts them. I have no comfort left inside of me. I am cold to the bone, afraid that if one of them touches me, I will crack apart like an egg. I sit next to my dead mother for a long time in our shadowy cold room, with my head bowed in a prayer that comes too late. Then I remember a thing she said to me long ago, when I was the child who needed comfort. We will not speak of him again. At the time, I thought it was because of his danger to us, his crimes. But as I sit next to my mother, I feel her move beside me. I swear I do. She reaches over and touches my hand, and I feel warm for the first time in months, and I understand what she was saying to me then. Go on. Forget if you can. Live. It is not so much about who my father was, this advice. It is what life is about. What death does to you. When I look down, of course she is not moving. Her skin is cold, and I know she did not really speak to me, but she did. And so I do what I must. I stand up, feeling out my new role. I am a motherless daughter now, a sisterless woman. There is no one left of the family I was born into. There is only the family I have made. My mother is in all of us, though especially in me. Anya has my mother's solemn strength. Leo has Olga's easy laughter. And I have the best of both of them in me, and the dreams of my father, too, so it is my job to be all of us now. Sasha is beside me suddenly. He folds me into a hug, and I press my face into the cold curl of his neck. We will be away from here someday, he promises. We will go to Alaska, just like we talked about. It won't always be like this. Alaska, I say, remembering this dream of his, of ours. Land of the midnight sun, yes. But a dream like that, any dream, is far away now, and it only makes my pain worse. I look at him, and though he says something, I see his thoughts in his green eyes, or maybe it is my own thoughts reflected. Either way, we break apart, and Sasha says to our slumped, red-eyed children, Mama and I must go take care of Baba. Leo, sitting on the kitchen floor, starts to cry. But it is a pale imitation of my son's sadness, of his tears. I know. I have seen him burst into tears when he is healthy. Now he just leaks water from his eyes and sits there, too hungry and exhausted to do more.
We'll stay here, Papa, Anya says solemnly. I'll take care of Leo.
My good children, Sasha says. He keeps them busy while I wash Mama and dress her in her best dress. I try not to notice how shrunken and thin she is. Not really my mother at all, but it is true what they say. Children become adults who become children again. I cannot help thinking of this cycle as I gently wash my mother's body and button her buttons and pin her hair. When I am done, she looks like she is sleeping, and I bend down and kiss her cold, cold cheek and whisper my goodbye. Then it is time. Sasha and I dress for the cold. I put on everything I own. 4 pairs of socks, my mother's oversized valenki pants, dresses, sweaters. I can barely fit into my coat, and once I have wrapped the scarf around my head, my face looks like a child's. Out we go, into the cold, black day. Street lamps are on in places, their light blurred by falling snow. We tie Mama to the little red sled that once was a familiar toy, and now is perhaps our most important possession. Sasha is strong enough to drag it through the heavy snow, thank God. I am weak. I try to hide it from my husband, but how can I? Every step through the knee-deep snow is a torture for me. My breath comes in great, burning gasps. I want to sit down, but I know better. In front of us, a man weaves drunkenly forward, clutches a street lamp and bends over, breathing hard. We walk past him. This is what we do now, what we have become. When I look back, breathing hard myself, he has fallen in the snow. I know that when we go home, we will see his blue frozen body. Don't look, Sasha says. I see anyway, I say, and keep trudging forward. How can I not see? Rumors are that 3,000 people a day are dying, mostly old men and young children. We women are stronger somehow. Thankfully, Sasha is in the army, so we only have to stand in line a few hours for a death certificate. We will lose Mama's food ration, but lying about her death is more dangerous than starving. By the time we leave the warmth of standing in line, I am beyond exhausted. The hunger is gnawing at my belly, and I feel so lightheaded that sometimes I cry for no reason. The tears freeze on my cheeks instantly. There are street lamps on at the cemetery, although I wish it were dark. In the falling snow, the bodies are hidden, coated in white, but there is no mistaking them. Corpses stacked like firewood at the cemetery gates. The ground is too frozen for burial. I should have known this. I would have known it if my mind were working, but hunger has made me stupid and slow. Sasha looks at me. The sadness in his eyes is unbearable. I want to give in then. Just slump into the snow and stop caring. I can't leave her here, I say, unable to even count the bodies. Neither can I bring her home again. It is what too many neighbors have done, just set aside a place for the dead in their apartments, but I cannot do it. Sasha nods and moves forward, dragging the sled around the snowy mounds and into the dark, quiet cemetery. We hold hands. It is the only way we can know where the other is. We find an open space beneath a tree laced with snow and frost. I hope this tree will be the protector for her I was not. Our voices echo through the falling snow as we tell each other this is the place. I will always know this tree, recognize it, and here I will find her again someday, or at least I will stand here and remember her. From now on, I will always remember her on the 14th of December, wherever I am. It is not much, but it is something. I kneel in the snow. Even with gloves on, my fingers are trembling with cold as I untie the ropes and release her frozen body. I am sorry, Mama, I whisper, my teeth chattering. I touch her face in the darkness like a blind woman, trying to remember how she looks. I'll come back in the spring. Come on, Sasha says, pulling me to my feet. I know better than to kneel, even for this in the snow. Already my knees are colder. Soon I will not be able to feel my legs. We leave her there. Alone. It is all we can do, Sasha says later as we trudge for home, our breathing ragged. All I want to do is lie down. I am so hungry and so tired and so sad. I do not even care if I die. Yes, I say. I don't care. I just want to stop. But Sasha is there, urging me forward. And when we get home and our children climb into bed with us, I thank God my husband is there. Don't you give up, he whispers to me in bed that night. I will find a way to get you out of here. I promise. I agree not to give up, though I don't know what it even means then. And in the morning, he kisses my cheek, whispers that he loves me. And he leaves. In late December, the city slowly freezes to death. It is dark almost all of the time. Birds drop from the sky like stones. The crows die first. I remember that. It is impossibly cold. 20 degrees below zero becomes normal. The streetcars stop in their tracks like children's toys that have fallen out of favor. The water mains burst. The sleds are everywhere now. Women drag them through the streets to carry things home. Wood from burned-out buildings, buckets of water from the Neva River, anything they can burn or eat. You'd be amazed what you can eat. There are rumors that the sausage sold in the markets is made from human flesh. I don't go to the markets anymore. What is the point? I see beautiful fur coats and jewels selling for nothing, and oil cakes made of warehouse sweepings and sawdust going for exorbitant prices. We do as little as we can, my children and I. Our apartment is black all the time now. There is only the briefest spasm of daylight, and very few candles are left to light the darkness. Our little Burzhwika is everything now. Heat and light. Life. We have burned most of the furniture in our apartment, but some pieces are still left. The three of us are wrapped tightly together all night, and in the morning we waken slowly. We lie beneath all the blankets we have, with our bed pushed close to the stove, and still we waken with frozen hair and frost on our cheeks. Leo has developed a cough that worries me. I try to get him to drink hot water, but he resists me. I cannot blame him. Even after it is boiled, the water tastes like the corpses that lie on the river's frozen surface. I get up in the cold and take however long I must to break off a chair leg or shatter a drawer and feed the wood into the stove. There is a ringing in my ears and a kind of vertigo that often sends me sprawling at the merest step. I know my own body by its bones now. Still, I smile when I kiss my babies awake. Anya groans at my touch, and this is better than Leo, who just lies there. I shake him hard, yell his name. When he opens his eyes, I can't help falling to my knees. Silly boy, I say, wiping my eyes. I can't hear anything above the roaring in my ears and the hammering of my heart. I would give anything to hear him say he is hungry. I make us each a cup of hot water laced with yeast. It is no nutrition, but it will fill us up. Carefully, I take a piece of thick black bread, the last of this week's rations, and I cut it in thirds. I want to give it all to them, but I know better. Without me, they are lost, so I must eat. We each cut our third of a piece of bread into tiny pieces, which we eat as slowly as possible. I put half of mine in my pocket for later. I get up and put on all of my clothes. My children lie in the bed, snuggled close. Even from across the room, I can see how skeletal they look. When last I bathed Leo, he was a collection of sharp bones and sunken skin. I go to them, sit by them on the bed. I touch Leo's cheeks, pull his knit cap down far enough to cover his ears. "Don't go, Mama," he says. "I have to." It is the conversation we have every morning, and honestly, there is very little fight left in them. "I will find us some candy. Would you like that?" "Candy," he says dreamily, slumping back into his flattened pillow. Anya looks up at me. Unlike her brother, she is not sick. She is just wasting, like me. "You shouldn't tell him there will be candy," she says. "Oh, Anya," I say, pulling her into my arms and holding her as tightly as I can. I kiss her cracked lips. Our breath is terrible, but neither of us even notices anymore. "I don't want to die, Mama," she says. "You won't, Moya Dusha. We'll make sure of it." My soul. She is that. They both are. And because of that, I get up and get dressed and go to work. Out in the freezing darkness of early morning, I drag my sled through the streets. In the library, I go down to the one reading room that is open. Oil lamps create pockets of light. Many of the librarians are too sick to move, so those of us who are able move books and answer research questions for the government and the army. We go in search of books, too, saving what we can from bombed buildings. When there is nothing left to do, I queue up for whatever rations I can get. Today, I am lucky. There is a jar of sauerkraut and a ration of bread. The walk home is terrible. My legs are so weak, and I cannot breathe, and I am dizzy. There are corpses everywhere. I no longer even go around them. I don't have the energy. Halfway home, I reach into my pocket and pull out my tiny piece of bread from the morning meal. I put it in my mouth, let it melt on my tongue. I can feel myself swaying. That white roar of noise is back in my ears. In the past few weeks, I have grown accustomed to the sound. I see a bench up ahead. "Sit. Close your eyes for just a moment." I am so tired. The gnawing in my belly is gone, replaced by exhaustion. It is a struggle just to breathe. And then, amazingly, I see Sasha standing in the street in front of me. He looks exactly as he did on the day I met him, years ago, a lifetime. He isn't even wearing a coat, and his hair is long and golden. "Sasha," I say, hearing the crack in my voice. I want to run to him, but my legs won't work. Instead, I crumple to my knees in the thick snow. I can feel him beside me, putting his arm around me. His breath is so warm, and it smells of cherries. Cherries, like the ones Papa used to bring us. And honey. I close my eyes, hungry for the taste of him in his sweet breath. I can smell my mama's borscht.
Get up, Vera.
At first, it is Sasha's voice, deep and familiar. And then it is my own, screaming.
Get up, Vera!
I am alone. There is no one here beside me, no lover's breath that smells of honeyed cherries. There is just me, kneeling in the deep snow, slowly freezing to death. I think of Leo's giggle, and Anya's stern look, and Sasha's kiss, and I climb slowly, agonizingly, to my feet. It takes hours to get home, although it is not far. When I finally arrive and stumble into the relative warmth of the apartment, I fall again to my knees. Anya is there. She wraps her arms around me and holds me. I have no idea how long we sit there, holding each other. Probably until the cold in the apartment drives us back into bed. That night, after a dinner of hot sauerkraut and a boiled potato, heaven, we sit around the little Borzhuika.
Tell us a story, Mama, Anya says. Don't you want a story, Leo?
I scoop Leo into my arms and stare down at his pale face, made beautiful by firelight. I want to tell him a story, a fairy tale that will give him good dreams, but my throat is tight and my lips are so cracked it hurts to speak. So I just hold my babies instead, and the frosty silence lulls us to sleep. You think that things cannot get worse, but they can. They do. It is the coldest winter on record in Leningrad. Rations are cut and cut again. Page by page I burn my father's beloved books for warmth. I sit in the freezing dark, holding my bony children as I tell them the stories. Anna Karenina, War and Peace, Onegin. I tell them how Sasha and I met so often that soon I know the words by heart. It feels further and further away, though. Some days I cannot remember my own face, let alone my husband's. I can't recall the past, but I can see the future. It is in the stretched, tiny faces of my children. In the blue boils that have begun to blister Leo's pale skin. Scurvy. Lucky for me, I work in the library. Books tell me that pine needles have vitamin C, so I break off branches and drag them home on my sled. The tea I make from them is bitter, but Leo complains no more. I wish he would. Dark. Cold. I can hear my babies breathing in the bed beside me. Leo's every breath is phlegmy. I feel his brow. He is not hot, thank God. I know what has wakened me. The fire has gone out. I want to do nothing about it. The thought hits before I can guard against it. I could do nothing. Just lie there, holding my children, and go to sleep forever. There are worse ways to die. Then I feel Anya's tiny legs brush up against mine. In her sleep, she murmurs, "Papa." And I remember my promise. I take forever to get up. Everything hurts. There is a ringing in my ears and my balance is off. Halfway to the stove, I feel myself falling. When I wake from my faint, I am disoriented. For a second, I hear my father at his desk writing. His pen tip scratches words across the bumpy linen paper. No. I go to the bookcase. Only the last of the treasure are left. My father's own poetry. I cannot burn them. Tomorrow, perhaps, but not today. Instead, I take the axe. It is so heavy. And crack off a piece of the side of the bookcase. It is thick, old wood, hard as iron, and it burns hot. I stand by the bed, in front of the fire, and I can feel how I am swaying. I know, suddenly, that if I lie down, I will die. Did my mother tell me this? My sister? I don't know. I just remember knowing the truth of it. I won't die in my bed, I say to no one. So I go to the only other piece of furniture left in the room, my father's writing desk. Wrapping myself in a blanket, I sit down. Can I smell him? Or am I hallucinating again? I don't know. I pick up his pen and find that the ink in the well is frozen solid. The little metal inkwell is as cold as ice, but I carry it to the stove, where we both warm quickly. Making a cup of hot water to drink, I go back to the desk. I light the lamp beside me. It is silly, I know. I should conserve this oil, but I can't just sit here in the icy black. I have to do something to keep alive. So I will write. It is not too late. I am not dead yet. I am Vera Petrovna, and I am a nobody. I will write and write on paper that I know I will soon have to burn, with a hand that trembles so violently my letters look like antelopes leaping across the sheet. Still I write, and the night fades. Some hours later, a pale gray light bleeds through the newsprint, and I know I have made it. I am just about to put the pen down when there is a knock at the door. I force my legs to work, my feet to move. I open the door to a stranger, a man in a big black woolen coat and a military cap. Vera Petrovna Marchenko? I hear his voice and it is familiar, but I cannot focus on his face. My vision is giving me problems. It is me. Dima Nevsky from down the hall. He hands me a bottle of red wine, a bag of candy, and a sack of potatoes. My mama is too ill to eat. She won't make it through the day. She asked me to give this to you. For the babies, she said. Dima, I say. And still I don't know who he is. I can't remember his mother either, my neighbor. But I take the food. I do not even pretend not to want it. I might even kill him for it. Who knows? Thank you, I say. Or think I do, or mean to. How is Alexander? How are any of us? Do you want to come in? It is a little warmer. No, I must get back to my mother. I am not here long. It's back to the front tomorrow. When he is gone, I stare down at the food in awe. I am smiling when I waken Leo that morning and say, "We have candy." In January, I strap poor Leo to the sled. He is so weak, he doesn't even struggle. His tiny body is bluish black and covered in boils. Anya is too cold to get out of bed. I tell her to stay in bed and wait for us. It takes 3 hours to walk to the hospital, and when I get there, people have died in line waiting to see a doctor. There are bodies everywhere. The smell. I lean down to Leo, who is somehow both bony and swollen. His tiny face looks like a starving cat. I am here, my lion, I say, because I can think of nothing else. A nurse sees us. Even though we are two among hundreds, she comes over, looks down at Leo. When she looks up at me, I see the pity in her eyes. Here, she says, giving me a piece of paper. This will get him some millet soup and butter. There's aspirin at the dispensary. Thank you, I say. We look at each other again. both knowing it is not enough. He is Leo.
My son was Yuri.
I nod in understanding. Sometimes a name is all you have left. When I get home from the hospital, I cook everything I can find. I strip the wallpaper from the walls and boil it. The paste is made of flour and water, and it thickens into a kind of soup. Carpenter's glue will do the same thing. These are the recipes I teach my daughter. God help us. I boil a leather belt of Sasha's and make a jelly from it. The taste is sickening, but I get Leo to eat a little of it. In the middle of January, a friend of Sasha's arrives at our apartment. I can see that he is shocked by what he sees. He gives me a box from Sasha. As soon as he is gone, we crowd around to look at it. Even Leo is smiling. Inside are evacuation papers. We are to leave on the 20th. Beneath the papers is a coil of fresh sausage and a bag of nuts. In utter darkness, I pack up the whole of my life. Not that there is much left. Honestly, I do not know what I have taken and what I have left behind. Most of our possessions have either frozen or been burned. But I remember to take my writings and my father's, and my last book of poetry by Anna Akhmatova. I take all the food we have, the sausage, half a bag of onions, 4 pieces of bread, some oil cakes, 1/4 of a jar of sunflower oil, and the last of the sauerkraut. I have to carry Leo. With his swollen feet and boil-covered arms, he can barely move. And I don't have it in me to waken him when he sleeps. The three of us leave in the darkness of mid-morning. Little Anya carries our only suitcase filled with food. All our clothes we are wearing. It is bitter cold outside and snowing hard. I hold her hand on the long walk to the train station, and once there we are both exhausted. In the train we cram together. We are three of many. But no one talks. The air smells musty, of body odor and bad breath and death. It is a smell we all recognize. I pull my babies close around me. I give Leo and Anya some wine to drink, but Leo is not happy with that. I cannot take out my food, not in this crowded train car. I could be killed for the oil cakes, let alone the sausage. I dig deep in my coat pocket, which I have filled with dirt from the ground outside the burned Badeyev food warehouses. Leo eats the dirty, sugary particles greedily and cries for more. I do the only thing I can think of. I cut my finger and put it in his mouth. Like a newborn baby, he sucks on my finger, drinking my warm blood. It hurts, but not as much as hearing the congestion in his lungs or feeling the heat in his forehead. In a quiet voice, I tell them stories of their father and me, of a fairy tale love that seems so far away. Somewhere along that clackety trip, when I am so afraid and Leo is coughing terribly and Anya keeps asking when we will see Papa, I begin to call my husband a prince and Comrade Stalin the Black Knight, and the Neva River takes on magical powers. The train trip seems to last for a long time. My insides ache from being rattled around for so many hours. My fairy tale is the only thing that keeps us all sane. Without it, I think I might begin crying or screaming and never stop. Finally, we reach the edge of Lake Ladoga. There is ice as far as I can see. There is almost no difference between my view through a clean window and one through the fog of my own breath. We are at the start of the ice road. 25. The army has been working for months to make a road across frozen Lake Ladoga. The road is here now, and everyone is calling it the Road of Life. Soon, they say, transports of food will rumble across the ice toward Leningrad. Up until now, those same trucks kept falling through into the freezing black waters below. And, of course, the Germans vomit constantly. I check my children's clothes. Everything is in place, just as it was when we left Leningrad. Leo and Anya are wrapped in newsprint, and then in all the clothes they own. We wrap scarves around our heads and necks. I try to cover everything, even Leo's small red nose. Outside, it hurts when I take a breath. My lungs ache. Beside me, Leo starts to cough. A full moon rises in the black sky, turning the snow blue. We stand around, all of us, matted together like cattle. Many people are coughing. Somewhere a child is crying. It occurs to me to wish that it were Leo. His quiet scares me.
"What do we do, Mama?" Anya says.
"We find the truck. Here, take my hand." My eyes water and sting as I start forward. Leo is in my arms, and as thin as he is, he weighs me down so that I can hardly move. Every step takes concentration, willpower. I have to lean into the howling wind. The only real thing in this icy blue and black world is my daughter's hand in mine. Somewhere, far away, I hear an engine idling and then roaring. It is a convoy, I hope. "Come!" I shout into the wind, or mean to. I am so cold, my knees hurt. It hurts even to bend my fingers enough to hold Anya's hand. I walk, and walk, and walk. And there is nothing. Just ice and black sky and the distant popping of anti-aircraft guns. I think I must hurry, and my babies. And then Sasha is beside me. I can feel the warmth of his breath. He is whispering about love and the place we will build for ourselves in Alaska, and he tells me it's okay for me to rest. "Just for a moment," I say, falling to my knees before the words are even out of my mouth. The world is totally quiet then. Somewhere, someone laughs, and it sounds just like Olga. I will go find her as soon as I have a nap. This is the thought I have. And I close my eyes.
"Mama! Mama! Mama!"
She is screaming in my face. I open my eyes slowly and see Anya. My daughter has pulled off her scarf and wrapped it around my neck.
"You have to get up, Mama," she says, tugging at me.
I look down. Leo is limp in my arms, his head lolled back, but I can feel his breathing. I uncoil the scarf from around my neck and rewrap Anya's face. "Never take your scarf off again. Do not give it to anyone, not even me."
"But I love you, Mama."
And there is my strength. Gritting my teeth against the pain that will come, I stagger to my feet and start moving again. One step at a time, until a lorry materializes in front of me. A man dressed in baggy white camouflage is standing beside the door, smoking a cigarette. The smell of it makes me think of my mother. "A ride across the ice," I say, hearing how cracked and weak my voice is. The man's face is not drawn or gaunt. This means he is somebody, or in the party at least, and I feel my hope plummet. He leans forward, looks at Leo. "Dead?" I shake my head. "No, just sleeping." "Please," I say, desperate now. All around me, trucks are leaving, and I know we will die tonight, here, if we do not find a ride soon. I pull out the cloisonné butterfly made by my grandfather. "Here."
"No, Mama,"
Anya says, reaching for it. The man just frowns.
"What good is a trinket?"
I pull off my glove and give him my wedding ring instead. "It is gold. Please." He looks me over as he takes one last drag of the cigarette and then drops it to the snow.
"All right, Baba,"
he says, pocketing my ring. Get in. I will take you and your grandchildren.
I am so grateful. I don't even realize what he has said to me until later, when we are all packed into the cab of his truck.
Baba?
He thinks I am an old woman. I pull the scarf off and glance in the mirror above the windshield. My hair is as white as my skin. It is daylight when we get across the ice. Not much light, of course, but enough. I can really see where we are now. Endless snow. Trucks lined up, filled with food for my poor Leningrad. Soldiers dressed in white. Not far from here, 300 yards maybe, is the train station that is our next destination. The bombing starts almost immediately. Our driver stops and gets out. Honestly, I do not want to get out of the truck, even though I know how dangerous it is to sit here. There is gasoline in the tank and no camouflage on the truck. It is a clear target from the air, but we are warm. And it has been so long. Then I look down at my Leo, and I forget all about the danger. He is not breathing. I shake him hard, ripping open his coat and pulling up the newspaper. His chest is really just a brace of bones and blue skin and boils. Wake up, Leo! Breathe! Come on, my lion! I put my mouth on his, breathing for him. Finally, he shudders in my arms, and I feel a sour little breath slip into my mouth. He starts to cry. I hold him to me, crying too, and say, "Don't you leave me, Leo! I couldn't bear it!" "His hands are so hot, Mama," Anya says, and I see how scared she is by the suddenness of my yelling. I touch Leo's forehead. He is burning up. My hands are shaking as I reposition the newspaper and button up his sweater and coat. We are going out into the cold again. Anya leads the way out of the truck. I am so focused on Leo that I hardly notice the bombing and gunfire going on around me. Somewhere nearby, a truck explodes. It is like being in the eye of a hurricane. All around us, trucks are rolling past. Horses are plopping forward, pulling wagons. Soldiers are running, and we, poor starved Leningraders, are looking for rides. At last I find the infirmary. It consists of flapping, dirty white tents spread out across a snowy field. Inside, it is no hospital. It is a place for the dying and the dead, that is all. The smell is horrible. People are lying in their own freezing filth, moaning. I dare not put Leo down for fear he'll get worse. It seems like hours we wander around, looking for someone to help us. Finally, I find an old man, hunched over a cane, staring at nothing. Only because he is wearing white do I approach him. "Please," I say, reaching for him. "My son is burning up." The man turns to me. He looks as tired as I feel. His hands are trembling slightly as he reaches for Leo. I can see the boils on his fingers. He touches Leo's forehead and then looks at me. It is a look I will never forget. Thank God there are no words with the look.
"Get him to the hospital at Cherepovets."
He shrugs. "Maybe." I do not ask him to say more. In fact, I don't want him to. He hands me 4 white pills.
2 a day, he says, with clean water.
When did he eat last? I shake my head.
How can I say the words, tell the truth? It is impossible to get him to eat.
"Cherepovets," is all he says.
And then he turns and goes away.
At every step, people are reaching for him, begging for help.
"Let's go." I take Anya's hand, and we make our slow, painful way through the infirmary and across the snowy field to the train station. Our papers are in order, and we climb into a car where we are again packed in too tightly. There is no seat for me or my children,
so we sit on the cold floor. I hold my Leo on my lap, and Anya at my side. When it gets dark, I take out my small bag of nuts. I give Anya as many as I dare, and eat a few myself. I manage to get Leo to take one of the pills with a swallow of water I've brought. It is a long and terrible night. I keep leaning down to see if Leo is still breathing. I remember stopping once. The train doors opened and someone yelled out, "Any dead? Dead? Give them to us." Hands reach for Leo, trying to pull him out of my arms. I hang on to him, screaming, "He's breathing! He's breathing!" When the door closes and it's dark again, Anya moves closer to me. I can hear her crying. It is no better in Cherepovets. We have one day to spend here. At first I think this is a blessing, that we will have time to save Leo before we board the next train, but he is getting weaker. I try not to see this truth, but it is lying in my arms. He coughs all the time. Now there is blood in it. He is burning hot and shivering. He will neither eat nor drink. The hospital here is an abomination. Everyone has dysentery and scurvy. You cannot stand for more than a moment or two without seeing a new Leningrader hobble in looking for help. Every hour, trucks loaded with corpses leave the hospital, only to return empty. People are dying where they stand. It is good that I am weak and hungry. I don't have the strength to run from place to place for help. Instead, I stand in the cold, bleak hallway holding my son. When people pass, I whisper, "Help him, please." Anya is asleep on the cold floor, sucking her thumb, when a nurse stops. "Help him," I say, handing Leo to her. She takes him gently. I try not to notice how his head lolls back. He's dystrophic, third stage. There is no fourth. At my blank look, she says, "Dying. But if we could get fluids into him, maybe. I could take him to the doctor. It would be a difficult few days, maybe, though." She is so young, this nurse. As young as I was before the war began. I don't know how to believe her, or how not to. "I have evacuation papers. We are supposed to be on the train to Vologda tomorrow." "They won't let your son on that train," the young nurse says. "Not one so sick." "If we stay, it will be impossible to get more tickets," I say. "We'll die here." The nurse says nothing to this. Lies are a waste of time. "We could start helping Leo now, couldn't we?" I say. "Maybe he'll be better by tomorrow." The nurse cannot hide her pity for me. "Of course. Maybe he'll be better." And he is better. After a night when Anya and I lay curled on the floor by Leo's dirty cot, I wake feeling bruised and cold. But when I get to my knees and look down at Leo, he is awake. For the first time in a long time, his blue eyes are clear. "Hi, Mama," he says in a scratchy, frog-like voice that cuts right through my heart. "Where are we? Where's Papa?" I waken Anya, pull her up beside me. "We're right here, baby. We are on our way to your Papa. He will be waiting for us in Vologda." I am smiling and crying as I look down at my son, my baby. Maybe it is the tears that blur my vision, or more likely it is hope. I am old enough to know better, but common sense is gone with the sound of his voice. I don't see how blue his skin is, how the boils have burst on his chest and are seeping yellow. I don't hear the thickness of his cough. I just see Leo, my lion, my baby with the bluest eyes and the purest laugh. So when the nurse comes by to tell me that I should get on the train, I am confused. "He's getting better," I say, looking down at him. The silence stretches out between us, broken only by Leo's coughing and the distant rat-a-tat-tat of gunfire. She looks pointedly at Anya. For the first time, I see how pale Anya is, how gray her checked lips are, the angry boils on her throat. Her hair is falling out in clumps. How did I miss all that? But I look around. You said they won't let my son on the train. There are too many evacuees. They won't transport the dying. You have papers for you and your daughter, yes? How is it that I don't understand what she is saying to me until then? And how can I explain how it feels to finally understand? A knife in the heart would hurt less. You're saying I should leave him here to die? Alone? I'm saying he will die. The nurse looks at Anya. You can save her. She touches my arm. I'm sorry. I stand there, frozen, watching her walk away. I don't know how long I stand there, but when I hear the train's whistle, I look down at the daughter I love more than my own life and the son of mine who is dying. Mama? Anya says, frowning up at me. I take Anya's hand and walk her out of the hospital. At the train, I kneel in front of her. She is so small, wrapped as she is in her bright red coat and wearing the valenki that are too big for her feet. Mama? I can't leave Leo here, I say, hearing the break in my voice. He can't die alone, is what I want to say. But how can I say such a thing to my 5-year-old? Does she know I am making a choice no mother should ever have to make? Will she someday hate me for this? Her face scrunches in a frown so familiar it breaks my heart. For a second, I see her as she used to be. But you are my strong one. You will be okay alone. She shakes her head, starts to cry. No, Mama! I want to stay with you! I reach into my pocket and take out a piece of paper. It still smells of sausage, and my stomach churns at the scent of it. I write her name on the paper and pin it to her lapel. Papa,